June of 2000. A Lexington housing inspector stands in front of a little rental house on North Martin Luther King Boulevard, writing up 67 code violations. The tenant is a 56-year-old former tobacco hand named Forrest Brewer, who has told the inspector, honestly, that he has no problems with the place, because the place is all he can afford.
And as the inspector fills out the condemnation paperwork, he makes a prediction, to himself, almost a joke. The tenant, he figures, will most likely just end up in another house owned by the same landlord.
26 years later, we want to sit with that prediction. Because the inspector wasn't being cynical, he was being accurate. He was describing a system. From the Lexington Times, this is Town Branch. The story's running under Lexington. I'm Kay.
And I'm Pete. Fair warning, this one runs longer than usual, and it's a different kind of episode. Part history, part analysis, part commentary. Last night, our newsroom published a retrospective on Misery for Rent, the Herald Leader's four-month investigation of substandard rental housing, which ran across six papers in late August and early September of 2000.
Four reporters, Tom Lasseter, Mary Meehan, Linda Johnson, with Jeff Mulvihill on the follow-ups, and photographer Jahi Chikwendiu, who went on to win a Pulitzer at the Washington Post. We reread every page through the public library's archive, and what struck us wasn't how much has changed since then.
It's how little. The names changed, the prices changed, boy did the prices change. But the basic arrangement, the question of who carries the risk in a Lexington lease, and who collects the check, that's been remarkably stable. So today, then, now, and the machinery in between.
Start with then. The series centered on the family the paper called the first family of Lexington's low-rent landlords. By the Herald Leader's accounting in 2000, roughly 85 properties worth about $3 million, more than half of them valued under $25,000 apiece. Shotgun houses on North Limestone, North Upper, Willie Street. Rents of $200 to $400 a month, at least half collected in cash, in person.
And here's the detail that tells you what the business really was. The family patriarch explained, through his daughter, why rent stopped at $400. Their tenants lived on disability and social security checks of about $500 a month. The rent was set to the check.
Not to the cost of the house. Not to the quality of the housing. To the check. The revenue ceiling was the welfare system itself.
And it gets one layer deeper. The same family ran a side business at their hardware store on North Limestone, cashing checks and making small loans against the next government check. The paper documented a tenant on oxygen, living on $532 a month of disability, paying $300 in rent, who borrowed $160 against next month's check and was charged $20 for it.
So the same $500 check could be collected twice, once as rent, once as interest. In a 1997 deposition the paper unearthed, the patriarch was asked, under oath, whether most of the family's units were substandard housing. After joking that the lawyer shouldn't tell the inspectors, he said yes.
Now the family's defense deserves saying plainly, because it was not crazy. They argued they housed people no one else would. People one step from homelessness. At rents, those people could actually pay. Tear down every house like theirs, and you don't get better housing for those tenants. You get no housing for those tenants.
That defense has real force, and you'll hear an echo of it later when we get to today. But notice what it concedes. It concedes that the only thing on offer for the poorest renters in Lexington was misery. And the only argument was about who got to collect on it.
Which brings us to the second track of the series, the agency. Because bad housing exists everywhere, what made the story explosive was the Division of Code Enforcement, the city office that existed to enforce minimum standards, and what the paper found inside it.
Enforcement was complaint-driven. No complaint, no inspection. Which sounds neutral until you live it. An inspector at your door told the whole street and your landlord that somebody had snitched. And even when complaints came in, the paper found inspectors sometimes never opened a case at all if they knew the landlord. They'd settle it with a phone call and take the landlord's word the repairs were made.
The landlords were organized. the Lexington Landlords Association, about 230 members, some 7,000 units, founded in part by that same family patriarch who served as its president for about 20 years. Its monthly meetings at a steakhouse on Red Mile Road were a campaign stop for politicians. Its president in 2000 boasted, at a board meeting a reporter attended, that the group had gotten code enforcement employees fired.
An ex-inspector testified the unwritten rule was to go easy on association members. New inspectors who wrote too many citations got complained about, and supervisors would swap in somebody friendlier. And then the detail that turns the whole thing from coziness into something structural. The inspectors were becoming landlords themselves. Five of the division's 11 staff were in the rental business they were policing. One supervisor had bought more than $1 million of rental property in 3 years, including 6 houses from the association president himself.
When colleagues finally inspected that supervisor's own rentals, they wrote up 56 violations. His explanation of his career arc in a deposition was 3 words long. I learned the game.
The people who wrote the rules, enforced the rules, and profited from the rules were, to a remarkable degree, the same people. Nobody had to conspire. The system just settled into the shape of the people who owned it.
And the tenants? The series followed one condemnation start to finish, and it reads like a controlled experiment in what happens when a poor renter uses the system as designed. Forrest Brewer's son called code enforcement over his father's objection because the rear unit's toilet emptied onto the floor.
The house was condemned. The landlord's promised repair crews never came. Forrest ended up in the hospital spitting blood from stress-aggravated ulcers. He paid another month's rent on a condemned house. And when he finally moved to a cleaner, sounder apartment across town, he was miserable anyway, because the only neighborhood he'd known for decades was gone from his life.
Then the epilogue. The condemnation on his old house was lifted, and the rent went up $100.
A friend of his put the whole trap in one sentence. Poor tenants lose either way. Endure the conditions silently, or complain and get displaced. And maybe the saddest detail in 14 pages of newsprint. When Forrest was in the hospital imagining a better house, the only phone number on his bedside table was his landlord's. The man he depended on for everything, including small loans, was the man whose house had put him there.
That's not a story about one bad landlord. That's what it looks like when one side of a contract owns the housing, the credit, the association, and, functionally, the enforcement. And the other side owns a TV and 2 silver rings.
So what happened? In the short run, real consequences. The code enforcement director was reassigned to Parks. His interim replacement lasted under 72 hours after the paper found he'd intervened for his own father-in-law. The $1 million supervisor resigned. The mayor hired 2 independent counsels and ordered neighborhood-by-neighborhood sweeps. A tenants' association held its first meeting that September, organized through the Catholic Action Center by Ginny Ramsey, who, we're glad to report, is still at it today, a quarter century later, telling reporters this winter that Lexington is short hundreds of shelter beds.
And the longest burning consequence, the paper's own editorial demanded a community-wide effort on decent housing for the poor. 14 years later, that wish got a name, the Affordable Housing Fund, created in 2014. The city says local affordable housing money has totaled some $53 million since then and helped finance thousands of units, with $5 million more in the budget council just passed.
Real money, real units, real people housed. Credit where due. But now ask the other question. What happened to the machinery, the complaint-driven enforcement, the power imbalance the series actually documented?
Almost nothing. The sweeps didn't become policy. 26 years later, Lexington still has no rental registry and no routine inspection of rental housing. A task force asked for rental licensing and inspection more than 15 years ago. It has never happened. Enforcement is still, fundamentally, complaint-driven, with the same chilling math for any tenant weighing whether to call. The city only this spring began talking publicly about walking neighborhoods proactively instead of waiting for the phone to ring.
State law still gives a landlord 14 days to fix things after written notice. The same 14-day window the 2000 series found the agency routinely letting slide into months. The floor under a Lexington renter today is, structurally, the floor Forrest Brewer stood on.
Okay, now bring it to today, because the prices make the continuity almost poetic. Those family rental houses, the ones valued under $25,000 in 2000, they sat in the North Limestone Corridor. Median sale price in that neighborhood now? About $240,000, up more than 20% in a year.
10 times the value, same blocks. And the story of how that happened runs through an organization worth being honest about, because it's the well-meaning version of neighborhood change. In 2013, two young Lexingtonians, Griffin Van Meter and Richard Young, who was 24 at the time, founded the North Limestone Community Development Corporation, NOLI CDC, first place-based CDC in the city. They raised over $2 million from national foundations, started the night market, rehabbed houses into artist live workspaces, and helped turn the old Greyhound bus depot into Grey Line Station with a public market inside.
And the neighborhood pushed back. A resident told Young to his face that the CDC was, quote, a train of gentrification and displacement and change that was not going to be stopped. And to Young's genuine credit, he published that quote himself on the CDC's own blog and wrestled with it in public.
The sharper critique came from the late alt paper, North of Center, whose writer Danny Mayer spent years arguing that the celebration of a diverse, reborn NOLI papered over a simpler ledger. Low-income residents' rent flowing to a new set of owners, while a 2015 analysis mapped 187 properties in Northeast Lexington concentrated in the hands of just 7 private owners and companies. To be precise and fair, that analysis named private investors, not the CDC itself. And if you want proof the machinery never changed, proof nobody can argue with, it comes from an unexpected place, NOLI CDC's own radio show. In February 2017, on community station WLXU, the CDC's Chris Nahn sat down with a neighbor named Phyllis, who had been living in her rental for months without running water, hauling jugs of it home, and complaining to a landlord who, she said, just wouldn't fix it.
Nahn told her what any of us would have said. His words, on the air, being the naive idealist that I am, I said, you can just call code enforcement. That's supposed to be your recourse.
So she called. The inspector came out, found a bathroom floor that sank 4 inches when you stepped on it, and condemned the house. Phyllis got 7 days to get out, the same 7 days Forrest Brewer got in 2000, and the same day the Humane Society came for her dogs.
Her landlady, meanwhile, pressed her out the door her own way. Notes passed in through the front door, evicted, as Nahn put it on the air, by post-it note. Her rent had been $250 a month, and Nahn said something on that broadcast that deserves quoting, because it's the Robinson family's defense, 17 years later, from the other side of the fight. It's overly simplistic, he said, to think these landlords are willfully trying to harm people. The owners of condemnable houses really see themselves as providing a service, because at $250 a month, the alternative is homelessness.
2000. Complain, get condemned, get displaced. 2017, complain, get condemned, get displaced. The year is a variable. The sentence is a constant.
And here's a confession that doubles as a record story, which longtime listeners will recognize as a theme around here. Almost everything we just told you about that critique survives only in the internet archive. North of Center is dead, way back only. The CDC's old blog, where Young engaged his critics, way back only. And this newspaper's own earlier coverage of Grey Line Station, written in a much rowdier voice in 2023, when 3 of the market's restaurants closed in quick succession, also gone from the live web, recovered this week from the Wayback Machine.
The entire critical record of how a poor neighborhood became an expensive one exists because a nonprofit in San Francisco kept copies. This morning, for what it's worth, we archived all 110 episodes of the CDC's old radio show ourselves. Somebody has to keep the receipts.
And what's the fair verdict on the CDC era? The houses got better, genuinely. The corridor got safer, busier, more invested in. The CDC's flagship affordable project sells live-work homes to buyers at or below 80% of area median income, which is real, and which is also a definition of affordable that a tenant living on a disability check will never reach. The people Misery for Rent was about could not buy into the neighborhood that replaced their landlords.
In 2000, the neighborhood's poverty was a rental income stream. In the 20s, its transformation became a capital gain. Different decades, different instruments, same underlying asset. And in neither era did the people living poorest on those blocks end up holding any of it. Which brings us to the present tense. 47% of Fayette County households rent. The typical renter household earns about $49,600 a year. The typical homeowner household, about $100,000. Median rent is about $1,280. 46% of renters are cost burdened, paying more than 30 cents of every income dollar for housing. One in four pays more than 50.
Put it in wage terms, because this is the number that should hang in the air. By the National Low Income Housing Coalition's math, affording a plain two-bedroom at fair market rent in Lexington takes a wage of $25.58 an hour. Kentucky's minimum wage is $7.25. That's 3.5 full-time minimum wage jobs for a two-bedroom.
In 2000, the rent was set to the disability check. In 2026, the rent assumes a wage most renters don't earn. The arithmetic got bigger. The relationship didn't change.
And the failure mode got busier. Fayette County's courts disposed of over 6,100 eviction cases in 2023, the highest in the data we pulled, higher than before the pandemic, roughly 17 cases every day. The city runs a genuinely good eviction diversion program, a few hundred households a year, strong success rate, 17 cases a day.
You can hear all of this, unsolicited, on the Lexington Reddit any given week. And we'll label this as community sentiment, not data. A thread titled, roughly, "Apartment prices in this city are a joke," drew over 100 comments. People describing staying in poorly maintained units because moving costs more than enduring. Somebody quoting $1,500 a month for a one bedroom. Somebody displaced after 6 years when new management renovated and repriced the building. Forrest Brewer's friend said it in 2000, "Endure silently or complain and be displaced." The thread is the same sentence with a username.
Who's on the other side of the lease now? We did a whole episode on this, 2 of every 5. So, the short version. Companies bought 1 of every 8 Lexington homes sold on the open market over the last 30 months, and 2 of every 5 priced under $150,000. 509 more homes moved in bulk deals that never saw a for sale sign. The biggest holders are local, a home builder's rental arm with hundreds of houses, a two-man partnership operating from a Hamburg mailbox, plus a Manhattan-run sale-leaseback outfit signing its mail through a New Hampshire post office box.
The starter home, the exact rung a cost-burdened renter would climb onto, is the rung being bought for inventory. The Robinson Empire collected the bottom of the market at $25,000 a door. Its successors collected at $200,000, with better paperwork and worse addresses.
And when renters did win something in City Hall, watch how fast it moved. February 2024, the council votes 13-2 to bar landlords from rejecting tenants just for paying with a housing voucher, Section 8. The protection took effect March 1st. It covered the roughly 3,500 voucher households in Fayette County.
It lasted 6 days. On March 6th, the legislature in Frankfort overrode the governor's veto of House Bill 18, 76-19 in the House, 31-7 in the Senate, banning Kentucky cities from enforcing exactly that protection. The bill's champion outside the chamber was the Apartment Industries Trade Association, whose executive director praised the new flexibility, certainty, and uniformity for landlords. The association's lobbying disclosures show $18,000 spent in Frankfurt that session through some of the statehouse's busiest contract lobbyists.
In 2000, the Landlords Association worked the code enforcement office. In 2024, its descendants worked the legislature. The venue improved. The function didn't.
Now the counterargument, and we're going to give it its full weight because it's the strongest it has ever been. The supply people are right that Lexington has a shortage. The city's own needs analysis puts the gap at about 22,500 units, 3/4 of that for households below 80% of median income. We rationed land inside a growth boundary for decades. Housing officials will tell you flatly, enough supply, not even affordable supply, just supply, would pull costs down.
And landlord costs are genuinely up. The Federal Reserve found multifamily insurance rose about 75% in real terms in 5 years, and that those costs are at least partly passed through to rents. Property taxes, maintenance, all of it. A landlord who never raised the rent out of anything but necessity would still have raised your rent these past few years. The city, to its credit, has moved on supply, expanded the growth boundary for the first time in a generation, legalized accessory units, rewrote zoning for more homes per lot.
All true, all worth doing. And notice what the supply story explains and what it doesn't. It explains the level of rent. It doesn't explain the structure, why every shock lands on the same side of the lease. Insurance spikes, pass through to the renter. Neighborhood improves, renter's rent rises. Neighborhood declines, renter's conditions rot. Tenant complains, tenant moves. Heads or tails, the lease pays the same direction.
And notice the policy asymmetry, because it's the quiet tell. Every public dollar in this fight, the housing fund, the zoning reform, the boundary, is aimed at building more supply. Nothing in the public record so much as counts who is buying the existing supply. A state bill to cap mega landlords died in committee this spring without a hearing. We fund the supply side. We don't even measure the ownership side.
So, 26 years. The Herald Leaders series ended with an editorial saying Lexington must not be a place where the poor are exploited for profit. That sentence got a housing fund eventually, and it deserves the credit. But reread the series in 2026, and what stands out is everything that was never on the table. The registry that still doesn't exist. The enforcement model that still waits for a phone call from the one person who can least afford to make it. The trade association that outlived every reform aimed at it. The check, disability then, paycheck now, that the rent is still sized to.
The inspector at Forrest Brewer's door understood the system in one sentence. The tenant will most likely end up in another house owned by the same landlord. The houses got nicer. The landlord got bigger, better financed, and harder to find at the address on the deed. The sentence still holds.
What would actually change it isn't mysterious, and none of it requires a revolution, just a city willing to look. A rental registry, so the public can see what it rents from. Proactive inspection, so the cost of complaint stops falling on the complainer. A public count of who owns and who is buying, the way we count permits and parcels. And in Frankfurt, giving cities back the power to protect their own voucher holders. 26 years is long enough to call waiting what it is.
That's Town Branch, a long one, and we appreciate you staying down the creek with us. Every number, document, archived article, and meeting clip we cited is linked in the show notes, including the recovered pieces from the Wayback Machine.
Town Branch is produced by the Lexington Times. Our voices are synthetic and our scripts are drafted with AI from Lexington Times reporting and the public record, then fact-checked before air. This episode contains commentary and analysis alongside reporting. Sources for every claim are at feeds.lexingtonky.news/podcast. We'll see you down the creek.